You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome back to You Can't Say That on the Broadway Podcast Network. I'm Tanya Pinkins, and this is part two of my conversation with playwright Blaine Teemer on managing the new normal of life with idiopathic hypersomnia. Talk about this fog. Are you saying that when, you know, I mean, I've read a lot of your writing. You're a brilliant writer. Are you writing on Adderall or are you writing from the fog too?
Both.
Okay.
Whenever the idea or something comes, and I would say, you know, I would say it has to be both. I mean, it may just be a little segment of something. Or a line or an idea. But, you know, it's very easy just to kind of jot some notes down. And then when I'm feeling better to kind of construct it, to kind of come back to it. And it's so funny because we had a long conversation about frame, like the frame of a work. And I think that's why I so get into like the frame and the structure. Because I need that kind of, that structure to be able to kind of like come back to something and start it and finish it. And I really have to learn, because also what happens is that there's, you know, if you're not sleeping, there's cognitive impairment. So a lot of times I will forget or not remember how to write the structure of a play. And I have to, each time I do something, I have to learn it from scratch, which sounds crazy.
Well, that sounds like that would make me want to kill myself. Like, well, is it like starting to walk again? Like starting to, like you're learning again?
Yes.
Are you kidding me?
Mm-mm. So each time what I used to do is I used to write a lot of different, like, you know, I would write a book or I would write a play or I would write a television script. And each time I went back to do the other one, I had to relearn how to do it. So that's why I've kind of stuck to the play format now. And I try to kind of stay within that because I really would not know how to write a book. Again.
But we have to tell people they have to read your book, Shady. It's hysterical. You can buy it on Amazon.
You can buy it on Amazon, yes. So I would have for me to try to do that again, I would have to really study the whole process and structure of how to write a book all over again. I couldn't just do it from, I'm just going to start writing the story. But, you know, I really get attached to like the frame of things. And with the play, there is a structure. And so a lot of times I'll even do things like I was sending you Excel documents and I was just like, just plug in the information in the Excel document and then your story will kind of come. You're like, what are you talking about?
Exactly. No. I mean, I asked you to share with me your frame and then I would try to fit my story ideas into the frame and my mind doesn't work that way. So I could see your frame, but for me, that's always been the challenge for me with writing because I went to writing school and twice. And I feel like for me, oftentimes structure is what will make my writing not good because I'm a good student. And so I can do your structure. And so I've got a lot of really, you know, boring stories with great structure. But the characters don't breathe and they're not very alive and the dialogue's not very good. But the structure happens, like all the things that are supposed to happen here and there and all of that, that's there.
Right. Right. The only way I can kind of do it is
it must be because somehow you have synthesized your understanding of human nature and relationship must be so embedded in you that then you can put that into a structure. Whereas for me, I think as an actor, I live in the sensuality of the memory of every moment. So I'm writing, I wanna linger in every moment and the detail of this. And, you know, people often say my scripts are too prosaic, that there's too much of a novel in them. But that's what I enjoy in the writing process, is the detail. That's what you get to do as an actor. You get to dwell in detail. So I need to do that, and then maybe go back and carve out a structure out of this massive detailed thing that I have. But I need to live in the sights and the sounds and the tastes and the smells when I'm writing.
Right. And I think it's because you're coming from it, possibly from the actress perspective into it. And for me, it's always interesting to write because I don't have that. And so I'm really trying to I have to come at it from a different angle. So it's always interesting to hear when people interpret the work. Because for me, all those nuances and things are in there. And it's really about how the actor decides to kind of interpret it, because two people can interpret lines in completely different ways, and you pull out something, they can bring to light some two totally different aspects of it.
Totally.
And so as a writer, I'm not always going to be in the room or have privy to being asked to give input. So I'm really trying to put in there, because everything that I am writing is based upon things that I've seen or experienced or listened to or heard. And it's always really interesting when people, you know, we've been in situations together where people are doing the work and they're like, I don't understand this. Like, I don't get it. And you're like, if you just play yourself, you'll be fine. That's why I asked you to do it. If you can just read it and project, you'll be fine. You know, and I don't know if particularly, it's interesting because I don't know if what I'm doing, if actors get the opportunity to always do. And I'm really just writing people that I know. Like when we did it in Los Angeles, Box Seats in Los Angeles, was it Frances
Fisher
was playing the mother, and when she walked in, she was like perfect. It was like that who that woman is in real life, that is who this mother is, because she was hip, she had on like this leather biker jacket.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these tight little, I mean, she was like popping. And reading the script, because it's a mother who's of a certain age, when she first did it, she played it like, you know, an older Katharine Hepburn.
Right.
I thought, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then she got it and she's like, oh, okay, now I get it. This is really kind of like the women that I know or me. And she played it that way. So I'm not writing like the stereotypical thing that a woman who's 60 would be doing, but I'm seeing those women. I live in Los Angeles, so I see those women all the time, and you would never know that they were 60.
Right, you can't get your mother to take care of your children, because the mothers in Los Angeles, they are not, they're not grandmamas.
Exactly, they're not.
Don't call me grandma.
So, you know, and I work in the entertainment industry, so I see these women who are in the leather jackets, in the yoga classes, in the, you know,
in the stilettos, like in the tight
in
leggings.
The stilettos. Right. So that's what I'm writing. And I know that you had said, someone had said that that they wouldn't do, people that age wouldn't do a sex video. I don't know if you remember that, but one of the comments that you got back was someone said that the characters were too old to be doing a sex video. And I thought about, like, no, I know people who are that age who are doing sex
video. Doing the sex video. That's when you're doing the sex video. Hey, I don't have a reputation to ruin. I can't get pregnant. I don't care what you think about me. I bet those senior citizens homes have a lot of sex videos going around. That's why that coronavirus is spreading through there.
Oh, my God. It's like the reality of what we live in, and then what, it's like this cognitive dissonance, because it's like there's this thing that we know that people in retirement homes are still having sex, and
more sex, you know, than young people.
More sex than they were before.
Yes.
But, you know, when in a creative way, when people write those stories, that's not what they are writing about.
Or they don't want to believe in that.
I'm sorry, what?
I said they don't want to believe in that. They don't want to see their mothers, their grandmothers in having those lives. But, honey, my 80-year-old friends tell me they are having the best sex of their lives. I'm like, I guess I'm going to have to wait 20 years.
Okay. Well, you know, that's something to look forward to, isn't
it? Sure is. Something to look forward to. I'm so sad. I was going to go to the House of Love this month, and they canceled.
Oh, what's the House of Love?
It's, you know, a sex positivity club. It's going to be my first time. My son went to school in Berlin last year, and he would go to porn sexual. And so he's already had those experiences. I have never been to anything like that because I was too square growing up.
Oh, wow. I'll have to ask you what that is.
Porn sexual?
Yeah.
It's a place where people get up. He said they wear a lot of latex and plastic. And you have to dress to come into the club. Like, I had to send in a photo of what I was going to be wearing in order to even be given the right to buy a ticket.
Wow.
And then you go to a club, and there's places for dancing, and there's places for sex, and there's places for every kind of sex or every kind of activity that you want to be involved in. And you can just watch or you can participate, but it's very much consent is mandatory there. You even have to ask permission to speak to someone. Like, if you don't say, "May I speak with you?" you can be banished from the club.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. When I graduated from college, I came to California, and my first job was as a treatment advocate for a gay and lesbian organization that we were funded to work with people who were HIV positive in South Central. And so I was like right out of Pennsylvania, came to Los Angeles, and my boss at the time like really kind of thrust me into this Black, gay, and lesbian culture of Los Angeles during the 90s. And I was sent to places like that, or like bathhouses or sex clubs or whatever, to kind of like you know, of all things, give out information. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't the most popular thing to do there, but I just got access to so many different like worlds, like what you just kind of described, and it was kind of like normalized, like it wasn't like a big thing. But I think one of the great things about having that job is that I think you had asked me about a while back about, you know, would I try alternative therapies? And working for that organization at the time, you know, having this issue, I began to search out all different types of alternative therapies and complementary therapies for my clients. And so I was trying acupuncture. I was trying mushrooms. I was trying anything that would kind of... that I felt like the client could use and that I could try that was okay for me to try. Exercise, yoga, meditation. So I was doing this like 20 some odd years ago. And, you know, psychotherapy. So anything I could bring, you know, go out, find, and bring back to the client and say, hey, this is something that you may be interested in trying. And I think I've kind of learned through that you really have to be an advocate for yourself, and you really have to know what's going to, you know, learn about your body and know what's going to work for you, because you will go into different, you know, all the different places that I've been to for different types of therapies. Everybody has the answer. And now after, you know, this year of like really kind of getting into it and learning what the disorder actually is, even now, when I'm going to sleep specialist, they are not specifically familiar with IH yet, because the research is just coming out. So they are treating it as if, well, you don't have sleep apnea, you don't have narcolepsy, we don't, you know, you have IH, but we don't really know what to do for it. And sometimes it doesn't even get that far. Like if I go to other doctors, they're like, well, what are you even here for? Like, why are you seeing
this? It's like you're more of an expert than the supposed experts.
Exactly, because they are working within their box. And at one point last year, I was trying to get into a sleep study at UCLA, and it was going to take a very long time to get into that sleep study. And so in the meantime, I was going to try to do a clinical trial because they were testing out some new drug. And what I had done at that point was I would have all of my medical information I carry in a binder. And it's all kind of laid out, and it's based upon the year, the speciality. And because a lot of times I would go, and the doctor would say, well, have you had a bloopity-blue test? And I was like, well, which test is that? I don't know. I think I did. I'm not quite sure. And so I said, no, I'm going to bring all that information in. So if they ask, I can say, well, yep, this is the test. This is when I had it. But what I found is that none of the doctors will look at that information.
What do you mean?
First of all, you have to think that you're going in for an appointment, and it's at most maybe 15 minutes that they give you. Ugh. So they are taking down their notes, and they're kind of listening to what you're saying, and they're taking the notes based upon that. And they don't really have time. I mean, they may thumb through it, but no one is really kind of laying it all out and going, you have a pituitary tumor. Oh, you have this sleep disorder. Oh, you have, like, this happened. So what's the connection between all of these different things?
There's no holistic approach.
No one was taking a holistic approach until I went to the clinical trial. And the doctor had to go through every page. And then he said, what about this pituitary tumor? Which I had forgot about. Because I had been diagnosed with it a couple of years prior. And so he said, well, you really can't go any further in this until you find out the status of the tumor. So none of my doctors had brought it back up. So I did go. I did get it. It had grown. It was secreting. And I had to get on medication for it. So I couldn't get in the study. But after that, no one really kind of said, okay, well, how would that impact all these other...
The pituitary is like controlling every hormone in the body.
It controls everything. So, but, you know, the endocrinologist, he's working within his own box. And so he's not working with the pulmonologist. And the pulmonologist is not really working with the neurologist. And another full cycle moment was I was trying to see a neurologist in Pasadena when all this started. I couldn't get an appointment. So, you know, that got put aside, and flash forward, I started seeing another neurologist who was not familiar with the disorder, but was not able to help me. Because what was happening was I was having cognitive impairments.
What's that? How did that look?
Well, you go and you take this very long, long test. And I had to take it over a couple of days because I couldn't stay awake through the entire thing. And they test your ability to do different tests, like your mathematical abilities, your ability to remember things, your ability to put things in order. And there were some things that I wasn't able to do. There were some things that I excelled at, and there were some things that there was.
Now, are you doing these tests on Adderall, or are you doing them Adderall free?
Well, that's interesting, because the interesting thing about the Adderall is that there's like two aspects. If I don't take anything, I just am like a zombie. I can barely make it to the appointment. Like, I'm a completely different person. Like, I wouldn't even be able to answer the person's questions. Mm. If I take the Adderall, I seem somewhat normal if you ask me the questions within a certain amount of time. So, you know, I everyone says that I present really well.
You present really well.
But what I do is I edit. So I don't answer the phone when I'm in these states. Like, I don't go out when I'm in these situations. And so when people see me, I'm usually like on a high dose of medication, but it has to be like really kind of timed really well. And a lot of times what I would also do is that I would have my husband come with me to a lot of these appointments, because what I realize is that I'm communicating to these doctors and something is not getting through. Like something is not, they're not understanding. So I'm thinking, well, maybe I'm not articulate. Maybe it's, I'm not making any, like, I couldn't understand like what the disconnect was. So having my husband come, who's also a lawyer, if I left out something, he would fill it in, you know, or he would, you know, fill in pieces of his story. And even with that, Tanya, I would see the notes, and it was something completely different than what we had discussed. It was something, and then, you know, those notes, which would be incorrect, would then get passed to the next doctor. And then, so whatever I was telling the next doctor, they would really kind of ignore and go by what the other doctor's notes were.
And you've tried to even get the notes corrected, like, and that's been a challenge for you.
Oh my gosh. That, trying to get the notes corrected is like trying to have passages in the Bible corrected.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
I went through this. I went to the Mayo Clinic, and the doctor listened. And when I got the notes back, there were just some things that were different than what we had said. And so when I went back to try to figure out, well, what do I have to do to get these corrected? It was this whole kind of crazy process where I was told I had to make the corrections, send it back, then they would decide. And then they would send it to the doctor, and the doctor would make a decision, and then they would let me know from that point. And when I spoke to the one person, I said, well, did you read the original notes? She said, well, no, he said everything was fine. And I said, but did you read the notes? Can you just take a, can we read it together and see what the notes say? And then, so doing that, she was like, oh, wow, I do see what you're talking about.
Yeah, because it was like misspellings and bad grammar. And
right. And she was like, well, you know, we don't really want to question the doctor. So I'm like, well, what was the point of this whole process of me trying to do this? You know, so it just becomes like I have to decide how much energy I'm going to exert in my day on a particular thing, you know.
Yes, and we've already gone over the amount of time we said we're going to do, so we're going to wrap it up with three questions.
Okay.
Who are you? What's needed? And how do you serve?
I think I am a person who is on an evolution, who is really trying to, you know, take in what life is giving me and trying to see how it can help me evolve and be a better person, and so I can continuously grow. And the thought of not growing kind of is frightening to me. What was the second question?
I want to stick with that because you said you want to come back to this getting stuck. And so like want to grow through this illness too.
I am really trying to, like, I am on a new page of this illness where I do not know what the future is going to be. And that can be scary sometimes, a lot of times, because I don't know what tomorrow is going to look like. But I am embracing a new normal. And one of the things that I said in 2020 was that I'm not just going to accept whatever a doctor is telling me, or just what anyone is. I'm not just going to give anyone the benefit of the doubt anymore. I'm really going to trust my gut more,
mm-hmm.
and ask more questions. And if something doesn't feel right, kind of speak to that and not just kind of give my power over to someone in a lab coat anymore, or someone behind a desk.
Because as we know, these people will just say anything because they think you just like, oh, I'm an authority, so I can just say anything.
Oh, my gosh, Tanya, they are telling us anything. And I used to be like, you know, maybe I'm just stupid. Maybe I'm not that smart. Like, maybe I don't know. Maybe it's me. And my husband is an attorney. He's very, 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 very smart. And so having him in the room, it's like, okay, if he's saying this doesn't make any sense and I'm saying this doesn't make any sense, then maybe this person just doesn't know what they're talking about. And we've been in situations like that where we're being told something and we just look at each other going, that is so not the truth. Like, you so do not know what you're talking. But it's said with such an adamant belief.
Yes.
Conviction.
So peremptory.
You know? Yeah. So you're like, well, maybe my name isn't Blaine. Maybe it is something different. I'm not quite sure. So you question yourself. And I'm not going to keep on doing that. So that's part of my evolution as well. And as far as not trying to get, I think those things made me get stuck, you know, mm-hmm. a lot. And so I really have to kind of trust my instincts and my gut and that voice, that really kind of practical voice that speaks.
Yeah, I mean, for me, having my surgery last year after 6 years of seeing 13 endocrinologists and 7 surgeons and till I found someone, you know, when they were telling me I could die at any moment. And I was like, yeah, I'm just not going to accept that until I find somebody who I'm comfortable with to do this. So what is needed?
I think empathy. I think empathy is so needed, and that is gone. I think it breaks my heart that the notion of political correctness is gone, and that was made out to be a bad thing. And now we're seeing how without it, it's such a harsh place to kind of be in.
Well, I'm going to challenge that political correctness because I think making people feel bad for not being politically correct is a problem too. You know, I've always felt more comfortable with a Southern racist than a Northern liberal because a Southern racist is honest and clear, and a Northern liberal is sort of performing tolerance and repressing things. So, you know, political correctness for its own sake, I'm not for, but good manners, you know, certainly if I'm in a room with people and I have a different philosophy from them, I can get through an evening with them and I don't have to argue my philosophy. I can just sit and listen and learn. I don't have to pick a fight with them.
Right. Well, let's call it that then. That seems to be missing.
Good manners.
Good manners. Yes. And I think too, with both sides, it's people getting stuck and not being really willing to able to hear the other person's side and understand it and have any type of empathy for it. Like there's that piece that's just kind of missing right now. And I don't know how we get that.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that with the internet and with the algorithms that all of us are getting such very specific information that our worlds are so specific that you might be upset about something that I don't know anything about because that's not in my feed.
Yes.
You know, I remember someone was telling me, I'm all for Klobuchar. And I was saying, well, Klobuchar, the NAACP is asking her to step down because of her record as a prosecutor. And they're like, I never heard of any such thing. Or I was talking to someone and saying MAGA was, you know, kind of a white supremacist trope and maybe not use it in this group. And they were like, MAGA is wonderful and, you know, forget you for being offended. And it was like, okay, I'm just going to step out of the group because, you know, we clearly live in different worlds. And if we aren't even going to honor the fact, well, it offends me, let's not put it in this group where it offends me, then I just have to leave because you got the right to love it. And so the only thing I can do is step on out.
Right. And so that's what I'm talking about, that piece, whatever you want to call that. You know, I call it the political, we can call it something different, but it's just like not being even curious to know, well, why are you offended by that? Or why are you so why are you so adamant that that's the best thing for everyone? Or is it the best thing for everyone? You know, and that element is not there anymore. Curiosity or compassion for someone else's situation. It's so amazing that, you know, we're in such this chaos right now with the coronavirus going on. But there have been so many things that have impacted people's lives and taken people out that people have not got excited or, but it seems like, oh, this could impact me personally. So we need to really kind of do something or be crazy about it. But there are all these things that are going on around us that people just kind of just, if it's not impacting you directly, people just have no concern about, even if you're connected to a person who it is connected to directly. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Does that make sense? Even if you have a friend who is impacted negatively by something, you just cannot be concerned about it because it's really not affecting you.
I think it's a hard thing right now. Like, I was really weepy this morning over the fact that I'm so fortunate that I live in New York and there's a grocery store a block away and all of these privileges that I have, and the fact that, you know, no matter what we see on the news, we're not seeing anything about all of the undocumented immigrants who risk getting deported if they were to go in for testing, if they are to get sick. Not only, you know, do they have to risk infecting lots of other people because they can't come and get help because of the risk of being deported. The homeless people, the people who can't go to shelters because the shelter is an infection place. And these are all invisible people who we don't hear anything about them. They are voiceless. They are invisible. And if we don't take care of them, because we don't take care of them, they actually can make it more dangerous for all of the rest of us. So we.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So it's all like the karma of it is all coming into play.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we thought we could ignore all of this.
Right.
You know, but now it's like you can't.
We have to take care of everybody.
Everybody. And there's enough resources and out there available that everyone can be taken care of. And we need to what we need is to get into the reality that that's the truth. There is enough for everyone.
I do agree with you. There is enough for everyone. But it's that strange thing that happens that I say, you know, there's so many artists who are giving away their product because there are people who will never be able to afford your product, but they will be able to be the word of mouth for your product because they get it for free. And then there are people who don't want something unless they can pay for it. And so, you know, there's going to be both of those audiences and you cater to both of them.
Right.
And my last question, go ahead.
What do people need so much toilet paper for? You know, we're out of toilet paper.
I know. What is that about? Because you can always just wash your ass with some water. You know, you can use a damn towel and some soap. I mean, like, what is that? I don't know.
Like, maybe it has some, like, other use, and nobody's telling me what the other use is for.
I have to tell you that I'm a toilet paper obsessed person anyway, so I just always keep a good 100 rolls in the house because I just don't like to. I don't like you get to the toilet and you're, like, you're all comfortable because it's like my throne. Like, I get there, I relax, I'm meditating. That's where I do my meditation. And if there's no toilet paper, I'm going to be enraged. So I always have a lot of it. But I don't understand what's happening now. I guess that's how I'm going to serve. I'm going to have to loan some toilet paper out to people.
You're going to have to roll out.
And how do you serve, Blaine? How do you serve?
You know what? That's so amazing because as I was having this epiphany about what my new normal is and moving forward, I thought, you know, how can I want to be able to help people, and how can I do this with my new normal? And then I swear that day I got a call from you saying, I want you to be on my podcast and to talk about idiopathic hypersomnia. I'm like, oh my gosh, this would be so wonderful to be able to kind of, because, you know, people, it's a small population, but people don't know they have it. And it maybe more people have it than they realize. And but testing is very difficult. It's very expensive. And so to kind of bring a little bit of awareness to it and let people know that there's a community of people out there, there's a place online they can go to, the Hypersomnia Foundation. And there's tons of information and resources and up-to-date studies and research that's going on. And on Facebook, there's a idiopathic hypersomnia community where people discuss what medications that they're using to help get them through it and to help manage. So I hope I can serve that way. And I hope my work, for people who do get to hear it or see it, that there's, if nothing else, people laugh because it's meant to be funny, but that if you listen deeper, there's always some deeper meaning in it that I'm trying to get people to connect to and to understand, but using humor to do that. So I think I serve that way.
Thank you, Blaine, so much.
I love you, Tanya Pinkin.
Oh, I love you too, Blaine Teamer. And yeah, you're listening to You Can't Say That on the Broadway Podcast Network. I'm Tanya Pinkins. Thanks for listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can. I'm Tanya Pinkins. This is part of the Broadway Podcast Network, produced by Dori Berenstein and Alan Seals, edited by Derek Gunther, music by Anthony Norman, available wherever you get your podcast. And visit me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and let me know what you'd like to hear me talk about. For more information, visit bpn.fm/YCST.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.